Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi. My name is Nathan Hobson, and I'm a host for the New Books in Japanese Studies podcast, a member of the New Books Network. Today, I'll be talking with Dr. Aya Home about her book, Science for Governing Japan's Population, out from Cambridge University Press in 2022. Home's book examines the science and policy of population in Japan from the 1860s to the 1960s. As in other modern nation-states and empires, population has been in Japan an index of national strength and a preoccupation of specialists and policymakers alike. The book tackles the origins and changes of this interest in Japan over time and the mutual dependence of the development of population as an object of knowledge and management for the state on the one hand and scientific community on the other, and also looks at the symbiosis between the two. Science for Governing shows that population science was shaped by the shifting imperatives and ideologies of the state and the socio-political and economic conditions in which knowledge was produced. All right, Dr. Home, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for joining us and for arranging the schedule here so that we could meet while you're in Japan and I'm here in Europe. So we're going to be talking today about your book, Science for Governing Japan's Population. And the book examines the role of science in Japanese efforts to manage the population. It's really that century from the 1860s to the 1960s, right? And you have this analysis of the intertwined agendas of scientists, of politicians, bureaucrat scientists, which I thought was a really interesting term, and maybe we can unpack that over the course of the podcast, and the symbiosis of population science and what you call, quote, state sovereignty predicated on population management. So obviously, this is a very complex relationship that you unpick over the book, not least because at sometimes a large population is, you know, national strength, racial power. Other times it's overpopulation, destabilizing, causing poverty, etc. So can you tell us about the three big frameworks that you're using to do this analysis, which I just want to lay out here? So you talk about the quantification of social facts, the co-production of natural and social orders, and then micropolitics.
Excellent. Thanks. Thanks, Nathan. Well, actually, thank you for accommodating myself, you know, my time here. Yeah, it's really lovely to be in Kyoto, although I'm normally based in Manchester. I'm not going to say which one is better. I'm just not, I'm going to refrain from that.
It's not a bad time of year to be in Kyoto, though, I'm sure.
It is an excellent time to be in Kyoto, actually. So as you said, so for the book, so I examine different scientific fields, disciplines or practices, you know, that were established from the 1860s. So, you know, roughly corresponding with, you know, Meiji, as Japan transformed from a feudal country to a modern state, right? So I did arrange chapters chronologically, but each chapter deals with a different medical scientific field or a practice, so readers can, you know, jump in and only read the chapters they think are relevant for them. But the book as a whole, as you say, deal with what I call asymbiotic relationship between the kind of formation of population sciences broadly conceived, and the formation of Japan as a modern sovereign nation state and an empire, right, which was predicated on population management. And for that, I use these three frameworks you just explained. So the quantification of social facts, the co-production of natural and social orders, and then micropolitics. So I must say from the beginning that these frameworks have actually existed for a long time in the field of science and technology studies. So sometimes they call it, well, they do often call it SDS, or and the history of science, technology, and medicine I'm familiar with. I was trained in. So for that reason, in the introduction, I actually encourage readers to skip the relevant section if they are familiar with the frameworks. But I am very aware that, and I want to reach out to a very important target group for this book is a group of students and scholars of Japanese studies who might not be familiar with these frameworks. So I spent some pages explaining how I use these frameworks actually in the introduction. So the quantification of social facts is originally a sociological framework scholars use to uncover social structures and dynamisms that are inscribed in the ways in which facts are presented in numbers, and to see how the specific ways facts are presented shape our actions or perspective on things and phenomena. So when I adopted this framework, I used it in a similar way that historian of modern China, Ton Lam, did in their study of national census taken in the Republican era. So which shows how the knowledge production accompanying the national census fundamentally transformed the nature of governance. By making the complex human world appear to be knowable and manipulable in ways that were not possible before. I just quoted Ton Lam's words now here. So you can see how Lam's use of the quantification of social facts focuses on modern governance. And I thought this was a very useful lens through which to seize the interactions or, the symbiosis, I called it, between the making of population science that represents facts and population facts in numbers and the transformation of Japan into a modern sovereignty in the Meiji period and onwards. And how the symbiosis normalized the narrative of Japanese population as a political subject that was essential for the making of Japan as a modern state and an empire. But then I thought the quantifications of social facts itself doesn't really fully capture the power inscribed in this symbiosis. So specifically, for instance, this symbiosis was based on this hierarchical power structures between the Japanese state tried to maintain itself through population management and the people whose bodies and lives became subject of state intervention under the name of population management. And so I wanted to capture that, right? The capture the role of science in producing and consolidating these power structures. So I use the notion of co-production. So this is the second framework I use. So the co-production of natural and social orders, as the naming suggests, insists on the kind of inseparable nature of how we make sense of the natural through science and the social through, let's say, you know, daily lives, in that it's all part of how we make sense of the world. So specifically for this book, I use the framework to really dig deeper into power that pivoted the symbiosis and what power this symbiosis produced. And so in the book, I make 2 points based on this this incorporation, you know, it's this framework. So the first is that the knowledge about the naturalized concept of population, which was actually constructed through policy-relevant academic research or scientific research, was co-produced with vectors that consolidated existing social orders. So the, and then the second point is that population science is co-produced with the consolidation of state power in order to intervene in people's lives via policymaking. Then, but then again, the danger in this co-production framework is that it often is too neat, that it portrays the co-production as a kind of smooth interplay between natural and social orders and, you know, between, let's say, statecraft and science. So to make it a bit more nuanced, I incorporated this third framework, micropolitics, to see exactly what the historical actors did in their daily lives and what concerns they had, which shaped their scientific or policymaking efforts. So I think micropolitics did two things for me. So the first is it allowed me to present stories in the ways that disrupts this narrative of smooth co-production, like I said earlier. And second, it was that it urged me to focus on kind of material and or kind of locally grounded institutional conditions that were really important in shaping the realities of doing science, actually doing, right? And policy making that get dropped if we incorporate too much on power. So that's why I incorporated these three frameworks. And then I hope, you know, taking these three frameworks kind of allowed me to kind of give a nuanced story.
Well, and I appreciate this about both the book and the way you've explained this, that because you're trying to reach out to different audiences, you know, it's not many authors say, yeah, you know, don't read this section of my book if you know what I'm talking about. But it is an approach that works and I thought it was actually quite useful for me in thinking about how to talk across disciplines, right? To say, well, look, here's something that people over here need to know. Here are things that people over here need to know. And I thought that was it probably speaks to the sort of longer term difficulties we have communicating across disciplines. And seemed to me like you might have experienced that frustration at some point or another and been working with that. So I want to sort of divide the book roughly in half here and talk about the first half of the book. So chapters 1 to 3, more or less as a unit. And this is the period roughly up to the real escalation of war for Japan in the 1930s. So it's covering a long period of time from the 1860s into the late 1920s, early 1930s. But this first half of the book is where you show how population science became embedded in the theory and the practice of government, both in the colonies and in the metropole, certainly by the late 1920s. So I wonder if you could tell us, what was the attraction of population science specifically for Japan? I think you've already outlined some of the reasons that more generally modern nation states have an interest in the quantification of social facts, which includes questions about population. But also tell us about how specifically population science becomes institutionalized as a policymaking priority and a focus of Japan's scientific community in that period that we're dealing with, from the 1860s to the 1920s, 1930s.
Okay, great. So thanks. So just to explain a little bit more in detail. So for chapter one, I looked at the establishment of population statistics in the Meiji period, in particular, the area that was linked to national census. And then chapter two was about vital statistics, like mortality and birth rates, etc., and how the development of that as a tool of public health was linked to the development of midwives as a healthcare professional group that was reserved for women. And then finally, chapter three was about the rise of the discourse of population problems, or jinko mondai, and how it became a policy agenda in the 1920s. And so for the chapter, I mainly focused on social scientists and economists, sociologists, and also medical researchers who wrestle with this various different population issues. So these are the first half, as you call it. So the question of the attraction of population science for Japanese authorities. So I suppose to start with, what I wanted to show, particularly in chapter one, was that the attraction of population science wasn't instantaneously obvious to the government, right? So what I mean is that so the established narrative, so in the history of science, technology, and medicine in modern Japan, is that Meiji nation building and empire building marked a watershed moment in history, right? Whereby the government endorsed Western derived modern science and technology, because many political leaders thought that those science and technologies were essential to build a rich nation with a strong army, right, etc. Right, that was that was durable enough to evade the waves of Western imperialism. So obviously that mass narrative, there's some grain of truth in there. But what I wanted to tell the reader with the story of population science statistics is that it wasn't always the case. So just to give you an example from chapter one, in the 1870s, the government officials weren't actually interested in taking up population scientists' argument that the nationwide census based on this cutting edge method of, from Western Europe was necessary. So they thought, well, we have population registers from the previous period, we've got, so they were called Ninbetsu Aratamecho or Shumon Aratamecho. So, they thought, we've got them. So that'd be enough, if the government office created a population register system based on that, instead of implementing a completely new method or system from Western Europe, which would be much more costly. Right. So there were all sorts of things were going on at the beginning of the Meiji period. And so it seems like this seemed to be a pragmatic solution on the part of the government. So for much of the 1870s and even into the 1880s, the government officials pretty much ignored the argument presented by the first generation of statistic experts, right? So in the face of that, those first generation of statisticians, who thought who was were really convinced that census was necessary, they really felt compelled, or they had to really campaign for it. So they argued that the census was a tool of civilization, and also they were trying to influence policy through using personal connections, etc. So this is what they did. But actually, ironically, in the end, the impetus for a national census didn't come from them, their campaign. Obviously, maybe it might have actually played a little part, but actually, mostly what worked was the external pressure. So this scenario, you know, might be actually familiar, right, with some scholars and students studying other Japan-related topics. But here it is. It was the case in the Meiji period, too. So that's one of the points I wanted to come across in the book. And the first point I wanted to stress, you know, I want to stress here was that, you know, the attraction wasn't always there. Well, having said that, obviously, as you read the book, so, you know, the government did ultimately take up statistics and statistical thinking and use those for understanding people and for policy making. So, for instance, in chapter two, I show how the statistical thinking created the infant as a statistical category, right, from the 1890s onwards, and that in a way that kind of went in tandem with the emergence of the infant as a social group that the government thought needed intervention, right? And how in turn this collection of statistical data about the infant, let's say infant mortality rates, helped the creation of social policies that aimed to promote maternal and infant health in the 1920s. And then that was enmeshed with a process to kind of professionalize midwifery as a female healthcare profession that was dedicated to maternal and infant health around that period. So by extension, chapter three examines how not only specific problems of, let's say, infant mortality, but the population itself, right, a very abstract concept, but the population and the trend of population became problematized in the 1920s as the term jinko mondai, or the population problem, joined in the Japanese lexicon around the time, and how that was tied to the policy discussion that then led to the establishment of the first official body to inquire into the population problems, so Investigative Commission for Population and Food Problems. So that was established in 1927. So by then, of course, the government officials were particularly attracted to population sciences because they presented a view of the society clearly in numbers, in ways that made sense to them, right? So, of course, behind this government appreciation of the population represented in numbers is the understanding that these numbers actually do tell a story. Right, and the story is about where the boundaries of the Japanese start and end, and you know where that the change in the population numbers or the population trend, as it's called, right, actually shows something about the nation's wealth and health and wealth, right? So either it indicates a problem or a prosperity or whatever else, population scientists promised that they couldn't not only diagnose the current trend, but also predict future based on the current trend. So that kind of promise was one of the reasons why the government was attracted to population science, because it made the government prepare for the unknown future, right? So at least gave the sense that they were able to with those numbers. So that kind of thinking was behind the government's appreciation of population science, I argued, right? And I also argued that this way of thinking itself was not always there, or self-evident, or just emerged naturally as a result of Meiji modernization, but it actually involved active campaigning on the part of population scientists, you know, so they to sell the attraction of the statistical thinking for the government but then, as I told you earlier, the campaigning was not always smooth.
Yeah, and I one of the things that's sort of interesting to me about this half of the book is that the exact narrative that you've just sort of wound up with there, where you have the experts sort of lobbying for their discipline as both a way to understand history and the present and sort of how we get there, but also to predict the future, is, you know, we see this over and over in all sorts of different situations, right? Whether it's seismologists who are, you know, talking about earthquake prediction in Japan, or whether it's, you know, American economists talking about predicting the economic future and here's how much we have to raise interest rates, lower interest rates, you know, central bankers. So this is very much the story of modern social and natural sciences and their interaction with the state. And I thought it was really interesting how you've sort of, you know, done that writ large story through this case study here in Japan. However, you know, it seems to me that the story takes a little bit of a turn when you get into wartime, right? And obviously, it's not a complete disconnect, but that the exigencies of war make a difference. And you begin to talk about this in chapter four, where you say war made population studies into a policy science. So I wonder if you could unpack that as a start to sort of get us into this chapter and talk about how the state mobilized population studies and population science then in the war effort.
Yeah, it seems like this one is the, this one seems too neat, right? The co-production. So when I said war made population studies into a policy science, what I meant was that the scientific activities or scientific discourses or scientific campaigning to problematize population for the policy in a way became fruitful. So these scientific actions did materialize into tangible policy measures during the wartime or because of the war. So I also meant that, you know, by that statement, refer to the institutionalization of population studies as a scientific field accountable for government policies. And specifically I had in mind was the establishment of the Institute of Population Problems within the Ministry of Health and Welfare in 1939. So in chapter three, I did detail quite a lot about how scientists and social scientists and medical figures who were really fueled by eugenics were really trying to implement population policies. And I did say that it led to the establishment of that investigative commission for population and food problems in 1927. But this was a government inquiry body, and even though I have to stress that it was a very important body. It was the first that was specialized in studying the studying population issues. But to be honest, the commission's activities didn't really lead to a policy. But in that chapter four, we're talking here. I showed how, you know, the proposals made by those population experts in the commission in the 1920s, some of them were, and many of the crucial ones were materialized into actual policy measures, be it eugenic policy or pronatalist policy. So another dimension was that the government at war provided an institutional basis for the study of populations, and that was because of the war. So the Institute of Population Problems, I think, is an exemplary case, right? That is, you know, relevant here. So just to explain how the war led to the institutionalization of population studies. As Japan entered war with China in 1937, initially political leaders actually didn't think it would become a prolonged war. Well, I think, you know, if you are, students and scholars of Japanese, history, that's kind of like quite a basic knowledge, but, you know, so they didn't think at the beginning it wasn't going to be a long drawn war. But from around 1938, when political leaders became aware that this could be actually a long drawn war, population scientists at that time also began to notice and became worried that the fertility rate, and particularly in the countryside, was getting lower. So up till then, when the government and population scientists talk about, you know, jinko mondai and population problems, specifically when it came to population quantity, what they were referring to primarily was the issues of population growth, or the, you know, or so-called population surplus or overpopulation. So you know, they were worried about mass unemployment, political disorder, food shortage, you know, which could be brought about by this ever-growing population. Now, in the late 1930s, Japan was at war. And when the government started to portray people as human resource, or, you know, jinteki shigen, I really didn't know how to, translate that, but properly, because obviously human resource, it just has a different connotation. But anyway, so the government then, mobilized people as much as material resources under the, you know, National General Mobilization Law. Government officials and population scientists, you know, experts noticed this falling birth rate in the countryside, you know, where supporters of agrarianism, you know, romanticized as the source of national power, you know. So the government rightly became worried and argued that something needed to be done with it. And to make sure that they were making effective policy measures, the government then set up this institute, right, of population problems. And so under the government support, population studies then really thrived during wartime. So I have to, I think that's fine. I wanted to say this. That's fine. We'll skip.
Okay.
There.
Yeah. So this takes us sort of to the beginnings of the post-war period, which is what occupies the final two chapters, and the conclusion. What's thinking about the sort of the continuities and discontinuities in the way that population is viewed in the scientific and policymaking communities was really one of the, you know, I mean, it's in many ways the big through line here. And the population management priorities in the post-war, include not just population control. Japan, again, you know, now after the war, limited resources, et cetera, et cetera. So you're sort of back to that. I did that pre-war, up to the 1920s kind of model of how do we control the population so that we can live with limited resources. But also this added sort of Orwellian term you have here, population quality. To what extent am I reading this correctly to see this as a return to the 20s and the 30s? What's different and how? And in particular, sort of how does this idea of population quality figure into that picture?
Thank you. So, I think this is an excellent question, because actually, I didn't actually think of my post-war stories in terms of return to the 1920s and 1930s, right? I did think about, you know, continuities and discontinuity, but whether that is a return or not is, you know, something I wasn't thinking in that term. So, yeah, I think I would definitely think about that question and trying to come up with my response in the research I'm conducting currently on involuntary sterilization in post-war Japan. So this Orwellian, as you call it, the Orwellian concept of population quality is actually it is a jargon. So, you know, it's kind of it is kind of interesting, isn't it? So, it is quite all-encompassing, you know, what is actually population quality? And it does actually change meanings and reference depends on who's actually talking about population quality. So getting back to the book, so chapter 5 and chapter 6 are about the post-war birth control policy, or the state-initiated or state-endorsed, birth control campaign, and popularized the idea and practice of contraception in the face of growing abortion rates. So the government tried to spread the idea of modern contraception as a countermeasure to this rising rate of abortion, which it was then was characterized as backward. So I just mentioned that the government was worried about the falling birth rates during the war. And in fact, they did take up a super pronatalist policy in the early 1940s. So if you look at the wartime policy and compare that to the post-war policy, in terms of policy measure to manage the population size or to actually make it shrink, it really does seem as if the government took a complete, like, opposite measure, right? Complete 180 degree turn. So the government then, adopted basically if you do focus on population quantity, the government did make a complete turn, right? 180 degree turn. But when you look at the government's response to the questions of population quality, they were quite consistent at controlling the reproductive lives of the people who were deemed unfit. I'm using the term that was used back then, right? So obviously, to call people unfit, not really acceptable today. Or call them kind of fit, that their biological traits were inferior. So that was also called. So this is why the government issued the Eugenic Protection Law in 1948, which was similar to the National Eugenics Law that the government issued during the wartime in 1940. But in fact, as historian of science and my dear colleague here, Aritz Meikan, Professor Yoko Matsubara, has argued, when it comes to, involuntary sterilization policy the post-war eugenic law was actually more expansive in scope, in that a wider pool of people could be subject to involuntary sterilization compared to the wartime eugenic law. So I guess for people who know the post-war Japanese history on a popular level might find this actually very surprising, right? Because Japan is, kind of conventionally described as a time of, democratization, freedom, right? So this draconian measure, which strictly aimed to control the reproductive bodies of the people with so-called inferior traits, right? It seems quite contrary to the story of post-war Japan, but it happened. So this was certainly not necessarily a turn to the 1920s or might not be, right? A turn to the 20s or 30s, but in fact, this was a concern that was quite consistent actually since the 19-teens, right? And unfortunately, I have to point out that this eugenic measure continued to exist until 1996, until the Eugenic Protection Law was renamed as the Maternal Protection Law. So here, what I wanted to add. So this is closer to what I do now. But what I wanted to add, which is something I didn't, what I want to add here today, which is something I didn't elaborate in the book, but really want to do, whenever I have a chance, is that While on the one hand, under the nave of birth control or family planning, which I spent quite a long time researching about and wrote, you know, two chapters for this book. So the government tried to promote a modern idea of planning a family, as it were, through modern contraceptive technologies. But this mode of like modern and rational family planning, which was actually promoted on the national level through corporations such as, you know, Japan Railways, right, was primarily targeted at the people, you know, married men and women who were, as it were, you know, fit into the government discourse of post-war reconstruction. Right. So those who were able, so those able bodies, right? So they were able to take part in the productive economic activities, right, through their work. If they're men and, you know, if they're women, through their reproductive work of childbirth and child rearing. But behind that was this draconian eugenic measure that aimed to suppress the reproduction of those who were deemed unfit for the post-war reconstruction, right? So, and many of them were discouraged from taking part in the productive, even productive activities, right? So by way of isolation, so you know, a lot of Hansen's disease patients were isolated from the rest of the communities, right? And they were institutionalized, right? So these things were happening at the same time. So this point is something I certainly, you know, I don't think I actually unpack quite well in the book, but certainly want to, you know, tell from now on, you know, in the future. Yeah.
Right. And so you've started to think a little bit about, you know, you started to talk a little bit about your current and upcoming research. And I want to circle back around to that in a second. But another thing that you dropped in there, which I think is worth pulling out for our audience, is, you know, the eugenics law in Japan is only repealed in 1996. And for some perspective, that's the year that I went there as a student for the first time. Right. So, I mean, this is, you know, it's roughly a half a lifetime ago, which is long in some perspectives, but that's not that long ago. And I think it does surprise people when they realize that. So this gets us, you know, with your current and future research, which I'd love if you could expand on just a little bit for us as we wrap up here. It's also related to some of the things that you're talking about in conclusion, which is the sort of where are we now problem. So your book, you know, roughly the sort of heart of the book goes up to the 60s. And it's pretty widely known, though, that in Japan is the oldest, fastest aging society on the planet, probably. And this obviously has enormous implications for the science and the policy of population. In some ways, to sort of you know, continue the conversation we were having earlier, you know, very much in the Japanese media and to some extent policy circles these days, we're sort of returning to that idea of population as power, but more the idea that population as power is the thing we stand to lose. Right. Not the thing that we are building up, but the thing that we are losing. And so this is a real sort of moment of crisis. And I'm assuming that your current work intersects with that. So I'd love if you could sort of take us transitioning from the conclusion of the book into your current work.
OK, so I might actually repeat myself. But where are we now? So, yeah, of course, Japan is, you know, the oldest and fastest aging society in the world. So other aging societies, you know, the policymakers there are really watching keenly what the Japanese government is trying to do. So in this sense, for the scientists and policymakers involved in population policies, they, by the way, they don't like to call anything population policies because of the tainted, you know, obviously history with it, which I describe in the book. So, but, you know, those who are involved in kind of population related issues, you know, Japan is an experimental ground, as it were, right? So responding to the call, so Japan, so since the kind of 2000, I would say 2010s or so, responding to this call for active aging, was actually proposed initially by the United Nations bodies already like at the turn of the, you know, 21st century. So the Japanese government too is trying to come up with like policy measures that enable active aging, and, you know, population specialists in these fields, you know, such as gerontology or, you know, economy, they're being assured by the government to act as policy advisors. So for sure that keeps them, at least, you know, some of these population experts really busy. But as a historian looking at the topic, you know, I can't help noticing this persistence of the discourse of population and population, people, lives, that is predicated on this notion of productivity, right? In this, you know, this what's packaged as an emerging population problem of aging and low fertility. So, of course, you know, aging and low fertility are always kind of presented as a set. So what I mean by that is that the persistence of the specific discourse of economic productivity that insists that people's lives were supposed to be directly linked to national prosperity, whereby people who are able to contribute productively in this way are, you know, hailed as heroes, whereas people who contribute to the society in an alternative way or not in the way that is, you know, directly beneficial or contributable to the, you know, GDP, but in the way that makes others happy, or, you know, by creating something that make people happy or simply just being there, you know. So these people are discriminated against. And so if you put the Japanese policy that promotes active aging, you can see that discourse straight away, you know, because, you know, so the undergirding idea that supports this government policy is that, you know, active aging can help solve the problem of shrinking labor market, right? Which is, you know, brought about by the low fertility rate. So I argue with this book that the fundamental premise or assumption about a population and a governing body that pivots the policy discussion on aging population today has a long history and still is very much present. So it's a very comfortable place to be in if you are an able body or if you are part of the majority or mainstream. But if you don't fit into the mainstream, it's actually tough. Right? So I think it's you know, it's really about time that this kind of ableist rationale that pivots both the population science and the government policy on population was revised. So another thing I want to highlight as well is that the fact that population science is turning into a policy science actually might not necessarily be a happy ending story for the scientists themselves. So to start with, it is difficult as my colleagues, you know, in population science, you know, demographers say, it is actually difficult to establish, let's say, an academic department specifically on demographic studies, in part because it is a policy science. So, you know, so there is a government institution that is specialized in population policies in Japan still today. So the Institute of Population Problems still exists under a different name, but still it does exist. And apparently that makes it somewhat difficult for specialists to convince the university, you know, their university, to create an academic department for demography. So So many, you know, universities do not see the point of establishing an institute or an academic department, but the government actually spends budget, you know, this kind of allocates budget on the existing, you know, population research think tank, right? So their own think tank. So obviously, as a historian, I'm very bad at coming up with projection, unlike my fellow, you know, colleagues in population sciences. But I'm hoping that this, you know, symbiosis story I talked about in the book will help readers to reflect on the past, and that will lead to a creation of more, I suppose, inclusive policies in the future. So that's my wish. Yeah.
Great. Well, and hopefully we will have a chance to get you back on the podcast to talk about some of that work in the future, once the future has become the past and we as historians feel comfortable talking about it. But until then, I just wanted to thank you for taking the time to talk with me today, and wish you well. Take care.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.